We have with us live in the studios once again, Jock Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover. Starting with, looks like we finally have, we finally know who's going to be running for the different races.
Here. Yeah, the filing deadline for the various races for the August primary was last night. And so the races are set. We now know who's running for which seats. For the two big marquee races locally, there were no real surprises. For King County Executive, it was pretty much everybody that we knew was going to be running. State Senator Fred Jarrett and State Representative Ross Hunter from the east side, and King County Council members Dow Constantine and Larry Phillips are the primary Democrats who are running. You may remember that in last year we voted to have the King County Council and the King County Executive be nonpartisan races, so the party affiliation won't be mentioned, but these are all longtime Democratic office holders. And the lone Republican lunatic, who also won't have her party identification, is former Cairo anchorwoman Susan Hutchison, who's also skipping all the candidate forms, so people won't find out how far right her Discovery Institute, she was on the former board of the Discovery Institute, which gives you a hint of where she's coming from. But she's doing her best to take advantage of her widespread name ID, without actually tipping any of the voters off to what she actually stands for or what she would do if it's elected, which is pretty dishonest and pretty scary. But she's running against, four different Democratic office holders, and, so that's going to shake out in the August primary, and hopefully she won't be able to slip by into the general because all the rest of the Democrats cancel each other out. Also running for King County Executive are engineer and former Municipal Public Works Director Alec Lobdell, and also comic relief in the form of Stan Lippman and Good Space Guy, the perennial candidate formerly known as Michael Nelson. Oh, hey, there's light in the studio now. That helps a lot. Thank you.
Thank you for turning on the light.
Yeah, now I can actually read my notes. For mayor, we have Greg Nichols and Jan Drago, who we talked about last week, former Seattle Supersonic James Donaldson, former Sierra Club Chairman Michael McGinn. We've talked about all of those. Joe Malahan, who's put $200,000 of his own money into the race. He's a former executive for T-Mobile. We also have corporate recruiter Norm Sidler. Kwame Garrett, who's the son of Omari Garrett, best known in mayoral circles for slugging Paul Shell with a headphone a few years back. And we have Magnolia resident and critic of the tunnel downtown, a woman named Elizabeth Campbell. We also had Mary Martin, who was a member of the Socialist Workers Party, had announced she was running, but according to the county, she didn't file her necessary paperwork, so the Socialist Workers, I guess, don't believe in government. Incidentally, King have had a poll on the mayor's race come out yesterday that shows Nichols with 25%, but he doesn't lead the field. The leading candidate is undecided with 30%. Also, we had Jan Drago with 17%, 9% for Donaldson, and others at 19%. So it really is pretty wide open at this point. The downside of that is that with the low information on the race and with an August primary in the middle of summer, name ID for the casual viewer voters is going to be huge. And of course, Nichols and to a lesser extent Drago have a huge advantage in that. We also had city council races. 13 of the 15 candidates for the four different seats, two of which are open, 13 of them are guys, which is a little bit disturbing. Of them, probably the most progressive, David Bloom, is running for one seat, the well-known housing activist. Local Sierra Club chairman Michael Bryan is running for the other open seat. I guess there's some sort of Sierra Club mafia thing going on with the different races this year. And Nick Licata is running for re-election this year also. So those are the most progressive. And we'll be talking about those races some in future weeks as well. For city attorney, incumbent Tom Carr is being challenged by police accountability activist and former OPA critic Peter Holmes. That's going to be a very interesting race. Port of Seattle has two open seats also because Lloyd Harris, we talked about last week, is running for another position, and Pat Davis is retiring, although she is not going to jail, as She probably should be. But we have probably the most most reform oriented candidates for those two. David Albro is running for one open seat. Rob Holland is running for another. Alec Fiskin, the former Port of Seattle commissioner, had announced he was running, and he withdrew this week, which is why Rob Holland jumped into the race. And then we have Seattle School Board, Bukta Geiser, who's the former executive director of Social Justice Fund Northwest, probably one of the largest grant-making organizations for nonprofits in the region. She is now running for school board. So is Charlie Moss, a well-known school activist. Those are probably the two names to watch there in terms of progressivism. Cheryl Chow is leaving her seat open, and they're both running for her seat. Rumor is Chow wants Sharon Tomiko Tanto's state legislative seat when Santos is widely expected to retire there next year. Other than that, that's basically the rundown. There are some other city assessor and those types of auditor, I'm sorry, and those types of races. We got that confused last week too, didn't we?
I think it's county assessor.
I think you're right. but anyway, we'll talk about these races in more detail in the weeks to come. It's an all-mail ballot this year, so you'll probably be getting your ballot sometime in late July, and a lot will happen between now and then.
All right, very good. Moving on, the Edmond City Council.
Yeah, this week the Edmond City Council voted 4-2 to ban plastic bags at stores. So you'll note that instead of imposing a 20-cent fee on plastic bags, the Edmond City Council chose to ban them altogether. Well, it sort of begs the question, why can't Seattle do at least the 20-cent bag fee? Of course, we'll find out with this upcoming election whether or not Seattle voters actually support their environmental leanings or not.
Well, it's actually the election in November. I think that's going to be on the ballot.
Yes.
Not the one in August.
No, the November election, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
All right. And an update on Nicholsville.
Yeah, the fine folks at Nicholsville, as previously announced, moved last night. They are no longer in South King County. They have moved back to their original space that they originally occupied about this time last year, and public land in South Seattle. However, this time the portion of the space that they're occupying is state-owned land, so they're putting an appeal out to Governor Gregoire and state authorities not to evict them this time, and hoping that the city will respect the fact that it's state land and not just move in and evict them anyway. So we'll see how that plays out. And they had widely publicized this as being their last move. I kind of doubt that's going to be the case, because it's going to be a struggle for them to stay in that space. But they're going to try.
All right. And moving on to the state level, whoops, something that you thought you hadn't heard, wouldn't hear any more about.
Well, you know, if Energy Northwest has its way, you won't hear a word about whoops. All you'll be hearing is the good things about nuclear power.
Oh.
Sound of crickets chirping. Yeah, Energy Northwest, which is a consortium of 25, that is most of the public publicly owned state utilities in the region, is quietly putting out money for a new nuclear facility in the Pacific Northwest. In a May 27th letter obtained by the Associated Press, the consortium asked each of its 25 member public utilities and municipalities to pitch in $25,000 each for further research into running one or more small reactors. And I love this quote: "Nuclear power has already proven to be valuable for the region." that says Energy Northwest CEO Vic Parrish.
No relation, I hope.
Well, actually, he's kind of the black sheep of the family. Mom never got over the fact that he has three eyes and glows in the dark. the quote continues, "Recent national polls suggest the public supports nuclear energy development." I love his insinuation. Yeah, I love his insinuation that whoops was valuable. It was valuable. It was a $2 billion debacle that's still being paid off by BPA, and that money's got to be going to somewhere. But yeah.
To the contractors,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's valuable for somebody, but it's also extremely hazardous for taxpayers.
And the bondholders
were we saying something a little bit earlier about the environment?
Yes.
Anyway, So keep your eye open, because that that actually is a fairly serious threat. There's some 30 different licenses that are currently live now for nuclear power in other parts of the country, and it's something that's being pushed very hard by the federal government, including under the Obama administration. So we're going to be hearing more about the return of a carbonless nuclear future. Coming to a nuclear wasteland near you.
It's helpful to remember. I think this is refresh my memory, but I think the Whoops bond default was the largest municipal bond default in the history of the U.S.
Is absolutely correct.
Right.
Well, the scary part of that is, you know, anytime you set a record, somebody's going to break it. So.
Hey, records were made to be broken.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Developments this week in relation to referendum 71.
Yeah, a gay rights group called WhoSigned.org says it will post on the Internet a searchable database of the names of people who sign Referendum 71. Now, those names will become public anyway if the referendum signature gathers 120,577 signatures and the Secretary of State certifies the referendum to go on the ballot. But WhoSigned.org says that a searchable database is necessary for people to know who's is supporting the repeal of the Gay Rights Domestic Partnership Bill that was recently passed by the state legislature. Of course, it's a little underhanded, I think, when they announce this now, just as the Referendum 71 signature gathers are going out to gather signatures. By announcing that right now, what the gay rights group WhoSigned.org is basically doing is they're trying to intimidate people into not signing the initiative petitions. And to me, that's very undemocratic. I think it's fine to persuade people not to sign. I don't think it's great to intimidate them into not signing.
Yeah, this was a variation on something that was done during the Prop 8 campaign in California and up here, where there was local groups that were publicizing the names of local donors to the pro Prop 8, that is the repeal of California's gay marriage initiative, which was successful. So there's a lot of the whole idea is public shaming and intimidation. And now, mind you, this initiative is probably not going to make the ballot. I mean, obviously,
120,000 signatures is a lot to gather,
a lot to gather in something like 3 or 4 weeks,
which is what they have left.
But on the other hand, you know, you had the Tea Parties, you have the whole church networks. It is possible. So there is a real threat that this will make it to the ballot. But you know, it really is kind of questionable whether this tactic is appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fine to announce it after the signatures go in for certification, but you know, announcing it right now as they're just starting to gather signatures, to me that's just intimidation, and that's very undemocratic.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, it's not intimidation in the sense that it's going to prevent people from actually signing it, because the people who are signing this initiative, by and large, probably believe that they're doing the right thing. So why wouldn't they not want their names publicized? But the issue is that it encourages vigilantism and it encourages harassment. And that's a problem.
All right, moving on to national and starting with New Hampshire.
Yeah, New Hampshire became the sixth state in the union this week to legalize gay marriage. That's good news on the gay marriage front. What was interesting to me about this is that the new law was signed into law by Governor John Lynch, who himself opposes gay marriage.
He's Republican, is he not?
No, I think he's a Democrat.
Oh, okay.
He just opposes gay marriage, as many Democrats inexplicably do. But the bill itself contained language that allows any church or religious group to opt out of performing gay marriages and would also allow those organizations to opt out of providing benefits to same-sex couples. Of course, you could argue that's not good, but in my mind, any church or religious organization that opposes gay marriage and gay rights in general is very unlikely to have gay employees. So in my mind...
I don't think that's true at all. They may not have out gay employees, but they have gay employees. Trust me on that.
Well, I doubt. I mean, for extremely conservative religious organizations that
would be surprised.
Well, it may make some gay folks make a painful choice in terms of where they work. But hey, to me, I think it's a good compromise here to have this law passed that allows gay marriage in the state, but it's a live and let live compromise that allows groups that don't believe they should be performing gay marriage, it allows them to opt out, and I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, consider the number of extremely homophobic, high-profile politicians who've been outed in recent years. And consider how much more likely a scenario that is among people who are not public figures. So I think there's a lot of people who are pretty closeted and who compensate by, you know, putting themselves in environments where their sickness, as they may think of it, is not encouraged. It does happen.
Yeah, but they're highly unlikely to seek out a gay marriage and then demand or want equal benefits for their gay partner.
Oh, I agree, but you said that they wouldn't work there, and I don't think that's true.
No, and yes, I definitely think that's true. I think a person who is an out gay who wants to marry their partner and wants equal benefits for their partner as a married person would have.
You didn't say out gay. You said every gay.
No, I said I think it's highly unlikely for people who are gay and have a gay partner who would want to take advantage of benefits for their partner, it'd be highly unlikely for them to work for an extremely conservative religious organization that doesn't support gay marriage.
All right.
Well, the archives will tell us who said what. All right.
At least that's what I meant, anyway.
Okay. All right, that's
and
fine.
I think
and
most
I, and
people
I
understand
I agree with
that that's what I meant.
All right. Let's move on and talk about the murder of Dr. George Tiller.
Oh, yeah, this is the flip side of the whole debate about, you know, religiously fueled opposition to what people do with their own bodies. The assassination, I don't even think it's fair to call it a murder, the assassination of George Tiller is kind of a low mark for what happens when religiously fueled hate speech and harassment, you know, meets somebody who is disturbed enough to take advantage of the rhetoric. It's been really interesting how a lot of the anti-abortion groups have used the opportunity not to denounce violence by the extremists in their own midst, but to turn around and, you know, the Operation Rescue statement on this was classic. Classic about well, we don't approve of killing people. Thank you for clarifying that. But Tiller killed a lot of people. He killed innocent babies, and just, you know, went on with all of that. It's a very, very, very sad day last Sunday.
Well, yeah. What I think is very interesting about this is that Scott Roeder, the murderer, he had a criminal record. He was a member of a right-wing militia. He had vandalized Tiller's clinic twice in the previous 2 weeks, you know, leading up to the shooting.
And much of this has not been covered by media, by the way.
Right, and yet local law enforcement did nothing to prevent him getting access to the clinic or to Dr. Tiller. They didn't arrest him. They didn't enforce any of the laws that are on the books for this kind of thing. And Tiller's clinic, in fact, they had continual problems with law enforcement trying to get them to enforce the rules regarding open access to clinics that provide abortion services for women.
Yeah, so they also had a very serious act of vandalism where the roof was destroyed and thousands of dollars in damage were inflicted literally a couple weeks before the assassination.
So clearly you
have the police did nothing.
So clearly you have the local law enforcement allowing domestic terrorism to go on here. And it really was a matter of time. Doctors who provide abortion around the country agree that in environments where the local law enforcement allows harassment to go on and allows the harassment to ramp up and do nothing to prevent it, in those situations, violence is inevitable, and it happens. You know, it's allowed. Clearly, when activists who do vandalism like this and are able to harass clinic employees are not pursued by the local law enforcement, they do eventually ramp up their tactics and violence occurs. And this case was no different.
The other thing that was interesting to me about this, I mean, the last time we had a major wave of anti-abortion violence in this country was under a Democratic president in the 1990s, and that included a couple of other murders of abortion abortion providers, although neither of them was as high profile as Dr. Tiller in terms of the amount of harassment that they had received over the years. And in both of those cases, those murders were followed by waves of additional violence, bombings, and personal attacks, and so forth.
And I think it's anti-abortion groups feeling that, well, with a Democratic president, you know, we have to step up the tactics and do more. And if local law enforcement and if the FBI don't step up to the plate and respond, and if the public don't get out there and say, look, this is a free country, you know, this is a woman's right to make a medical decision with her doctor, you know, if people don't step up and say that and support that, then the violence just continues.
I have a little bit different take. I don't think that's inaccurate, but I think one of the other contributing factors is that the type of hate rhetoric that arises on the right under a Democratic president really encourages this sort of thing. And mm-hmm. if for anybody who's been paying attention to listservs and sort of the far right echo chamber during Obama's candidacy and now that he is president, there's a lot of really, really virulent language coming from the right about using violence as a tactic to inflict their inflict their point of view on the rest of us. And when you have that kind of rhetoric, and when you have it coming not just from, you know, fringe listservs and whatnot, but from mainstream political figure or media fingers, like, you know, Bill O'Reilly is taking the most heat for this, but there's a lot of them out there, then you're inevitably going to get people taking them up on what they're insinuating be done. And this is going to be an ongoing problem, I think, in the future. And law enforcement and the public and the media have to treat it for what it is, which is domestic terrorism.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, just a few brief items. GM sold its Hummer unit to a Chinese company. Interestingly, the Chinese company isn't going to manufacture the Hummer for the Chinese military. They won't be allowed to do that. They're manufacturing it strictly for sale to the Chinese public, which made me say, yikes, oh my God. The Hummer, which is a gas guzzler and will contribute massively to global warming, being sold to the largest most highly populated country in the world, that's just a recipe for disaster. Also this week,
and particularly given the Chinese well-known affinity for destroying the environment.
Yeah, that will be an environmental disaster waiting to happen. Also this week, banks are trying to delay the Financial Accounting Standards Board rule that would force them to bring their off-balance sheet entities back onto their books. It turns out that 16 groups, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Mortgage Bankers Association, and the American Council of Life Insurers, have organized themselves into a group called the Fair Value Coalition. This group formed earlier this year to overturn the mark-to-market accounting rule that had previously forced banks to value their mortgage-backed securities and derivatives and other assets at current market rate rules. They couldn't value them in a way that they couldn't look at them and say, okay, we value these at X amount because we think that's what we're going to collect in the future on them. They had to value them at what the current market price was. That rule was repealed because of efforts by the Fair Value Coalition. That group got together this week and sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, urging him to oppose the Financial Accounting Standards Board rule that would force them to bring their off-balance sheet entities back onto their books. So I just thought people ought to know who is lobbying the government and what they're doing.
Lobbying them very successfully, I might add.
Yes, very successfully, because they did get a repeal of the mark-to-market accounting rule, and they're hoping to get a repeal of this rule about off-balance sheet entities. Also this week, FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair announced that she wants to force a change in upper management at Citigroup. Citigroup, if you'll recall, when we talked about the results of the bank stress tests, had managed to lobby the Treasury to lower the amount of new capital that they needed from $30 billion down to about $5 billion. Sheila Bair is concerned, This is interesting because you'll hear a lot in the business press, that's the mainstream press, that it's terrible that the FDIC, i.e. the government, is trying to take control of a major private corporation like Citigroup. in this manner and oust its management. Well, excuse me, but the FDIC is on the hook for all of the bank deposits that Citigroup has. So if Citigroup fails because of the actions of an incompetent upper-level management, then the taxpayers through the FDIC will have to step in and reimburse all of its depositors or most of its depositors. So the FDIC has a direct interest in the public interest in making sure that Citigroup is run well. And she is doing her job, and I think the business press ought to just shut up for a while.
Not to mention that, you know, when you have management that incompetent, there's got to be accountability somewhere.
Certainly
not coming from their own board of directors.
Exactly.
All right. Moving on to international and President Obama's speech in Cairo this last week.
Yes, he spoke to students at Cairo University, and he had a lot of interesting things to say. I'll just dive right in since we don't have a lot of time. What I thought was interesting in his section on violent extremism is that he committed the U.S. to investing $1.5 billion per year over the next 5 years to help Pakistan build schools and hospitals and other infrastructure, and $2.8 billion to help the Afghanistan develop its economy. I thought that was kind of interesting, given that, first, do we have the money? Does the U.S. federal government have the money to do that? And secondly, let's talk about the corruption in the Afghani and Pakistani
governments. Yeah, where's that money actually going to go?
That's been a problem up till now. The Bush administration tried to do similar things to no avail because that money went into pockets of the Pakistani military and elite, and the same in Afghanistan.
And you also contrast it with the amount of money the U.S. is still investing in its own violent extremism.
Exactly. And then he also said some interesting things about the Israeli-Palestinian situation. In particular, he came out and reiterated that, yes, the U.S. government expects Israel to stop expanding the settlements. Job, I think you had something to say on
that. Yeah, it's been very interesting. The State Department and various other officials have reported that Netanyahu and Foreign Minister Lieberman and other Israeli officials have been probing since Obama came out against the settlements for what the loophole is, what the little asterisk is, which all previous presidents have had. They've sort of winked and nodded as Israel's continued to expand the settlements, and they're not finding any. Obama is saying, well, I meant what I said, no settlements. So there's going to be some conflict with the Israeli government over that.
Yeah, and that's been very controversial in Israel at the moment. They're saying, what, you actually mean it this time?
Yeah. I think, you know, you can parse the various pieces of what Obama actually said, but the fact that he actually went and did this address and did it, you know, a black American president on African soil speaking to the Muslim world, the symbolism of that and what that means to the rest of the world, and speaking respectfully and acknowledging that the U.S. has made past mistakes, that counts for far more than the actual nuance of the text of his speech.
Yeah, the only issue is, will he be able to keep the promises that he made in his speech?
Yeah, a lot of people are going to pay a lot more attention to what the U.S. actually does than to Obama's words.
Yeah.
All right. And any events?
Yeah, we've got several events coming up today and this week. Our friends at Reclaim the Media, we have the DTV conversion coming up next Friday, June 12th, and they're going to be offering DTV conversion boxes. Bring your $40 government coupon, and volunteers will show you how to set it up, and you can take it home. 11 to 4 o'clock today at the Beacon Hill Festival at Jefferson Community Center, 3801 Beacon Avenue South. Also today at noon, the VF Veterans for Peace is doing a stop-loss protest. There's going to be new Fort Lewis troop deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, mostly by stop-loss soldiers who are being forcibly kept in the military after their contracts expire. That's going to be at noon at the exit 122 overpass of I-5 south of Tacoma. On Wednesday, June 10th, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility is doing an Energy and Weapons in 2009. How do we ensure a sustainable nuclear-free future? Vic Parrish will not be there, but nuclear expert Bob Alvarez will be. That's going to be free, and it'll be 7 o'clock in Town Hall. And don't forget, Eat the State is also getting ready to wrap up its spring fun drive, and we need your help.
All right. Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town, where you find free publications in bookstores, coffee shops, in community centers, and public libraries. We can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org.
With a PayPal button, I might add.
Yes, so you can make a donation to us. We always need donations, and we also need volunteers. So check out our website.